parity.
Understanding and coming to grips with economic phenomena is people's behavior.
Let me give an example. In 1719, Pennsylvania was looking for an equivalent list, how much wheat was good for how much chickens or pigs. You know, they wanted a long list of how they can make trades among themselves. And they wanted Whitehall and the Board of Trade in London to help them with this, or come bring something out official from the crown, and they never did. But they were looking for that just to get by with some framework of how to have a medium of exchange or how to work through their issues. And that never happened. And I didn't know the word. I've heard Saudi. I think we've mentioned that word once before. But
I don't remember it at all. I don't remember reading it either in here.
Crematistics, you mean?
Right. Yeah, I don't remember reading that. But in the beginning, he's talking about the purchasing power right away in terms of virtual wealth residing in the community, which was hard to wrap your brain around when we first covered that. It was in another chapter, I think.
I'd like to add,
crematistics is mentioned in chapter 4.
Okay.
The fallacies of orthodox economists.
Okay.
I just wanted to add real quick, the notion that Stephen talked about, what amount of one thing trades for another, mm-hmm. was the content of a lot of the tablets that were discovered from the Sumerian period.
Right.
5,500 years ago.
Yeah.
That's an old problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why we have, what's his name? Michael Hudson.
Yeah.
He'll give a talk. I think we're going to get him more internationally, but he could jump into the history too. So we'll see how it works with him.
Yeah, this crematistics comes up in Saudi, where you don't remember. He talked about the minus two pigs.
Right. I remember going through the, I read those early chapters. And
yeah, his point was wealth is a positive physical quantity. Positive physical quantity.
Yeah.
But debt as a negative quantity.
Which doesn't make sense.
It has no concrete existence and is to the physicist an imaginary quantity. If we deal with numbers, then we may, with great appropriateness, give them either sign. But in physics, which deals with real quantities, we can only do so with caution. The positive physical quantity two pigs is something anyone may see with their own. Oh, hi, Sue.
Hi. However, Randy, you could say today with the monetary system we have that the minus two means the death of some pigs or some people.
Well, that presumes, of course, that the money is in charge, not the people. In other words,
people are keeping the records.
If the money goes away, then we have to kill the people that it represented.
No, the debt kills them.
That's what I mean. Exactly so. The least number of pigs that can be physically dealt with is zero. It is impossible to see minus two pigs. Plus two pigs may be taken for granted before we can, even for reckoning, make use of the imaginary quantity minus two pigs. though we may with the utmost mathematical purism deduct two from one and have left minus one, we cannot deduct two pigs from one pig and have left minus one pig. Indeed, in pure mathematics, negative quantities were first recognized and justified by the Hindu mathematicians by their analogy to debt. That's where negative numbers came from. The economist would probably deny that pigs were necessarily wealth in this sense of the term. For example, if they were running wild and unappropriated, the pigs, I mean, not the economists.
That's good.
Assuredly, a buyer is not going to give anything to a seller for pigs which the seller has not got to sell. And the point seems a meaningless quibble. If the pigs were running wild on a private estate, they would be wealth to the owner of that estate, so that we reach the conclusion that it is all a question of private ownership. What is wealth after it is appropriated was not wealth before. So that in a communal, as a distinct from an individualistic society, there would be no wealth in the sense of the economist. This may be a distinction between wealth and not wealth in the mind of the economist, just as Mill stated. The distinction between capital and not capital does not lie in the kind of commodities, but in the mind of the capitalist, in his will to employ them for one purpose rather than another. On and on and on. Anyway, that's not chapter 8.
Yeah, where are you? I'm thinking.
That's chapter 4. That was what it is.
Oh, okay.
But that was, anyway. So gold value, goods value, the purchasing power of money, that's what we're trying to, my point in all this is in reference to the CBDC stuff, my contention is that central bank digital currencies accomplish the thing that is not readily understood, and that is that the banks become the determiners of who can buy and sell. Transactions are then governed by the bank's willingness to let you participate. Your transaction cannot clear as a sale, an exchange of appropriate tokens of buying power or wealth that you want to acquire, unless the bank says, yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely.
There's no connection between the creation of these CBDCs and creation of wealth. I mean,
there are even Federal Reserve notes can occur
right
on that basis.
Yeah.
You know, there's no difference in that sense between Federal Reserve notes, CBDCs, or grains of sand on the beach. They're unrelated.
Well,
how is Federal Reserve note and a CBDC so much different? I understand, though, I can make one thing. You know, going back to John Titus, and CBDCs can be tracked, and it works through the bank. So as John Titus says, if your social credit score isn't high enough, or they decide you can only buy things within a 1 mile radius of your house or something like this, and you can't do that, cash doesn't give you that problem. Cash, right, you can take it anywhere, and it's good anywhere.
Right.
Often to foreign countries, too.
Well, to some degree.
Yeah.
Usually when you cross an international border, they ask you for the currency, and they will, you will either be asked to surrender it or they'll send you over to the changement counter where you have to exchange it for the local coin anyway.
Yeah, I've traveled some and I've had to go into local currencies too.
However, that's one of the things we've been looking at in Peak, is that he's noting how many dollars were sent overseas, essentially like the immigrants coming through the southern border here are trying to get jobs so they can send money back to Honduras or Guatemala or Colombia. That does happen.
Yeah. If there are CBDCs, Western Union may be out, you know, a few billion dollars because of the ease of transferring money.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, Stephen, what's the nature of a CBDC in terms of the law, the Federal Reserve law?
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh.
I don't think there is much yet, is there?
Yeah, I'm not, even Powell says we would have to rewrite things a bit.
Yep, they'd have to have new legislation. And you know what happens whenever you get new banking legislation or new monetary legislation.
Zarlanga would say, usually it passes by one vote.
Well, yeah. And the fingers that are involved in writing it are all invisible.
Yeah, I know. All invisible. But in terms of anchoring, like Sadia is talking here about how gold was used to anchor the expansionary characteristics of their fractional reserve, which is what theoretically anyway the banks are doing now in terms of loaning, but I don't see that happening with CBDCs. How are they going to be limited through the central bank? Because what I've read is that the central bank, the Fed, is planning on issuing personal CBDCs. And the other central banks are saying the same kinds of things.
Well, are they going to issue them personally to Randy Cook or to Jeff Bezos?
Well, that's another issue.
And pick either one, and you can say they're being issued on an individual basis. But my guess is that the quantity that were issued, if Bezos's name is on the ledger entry, would be substantially different than with Randy Cook's name in the ledger space.
Probably, and at least what we can see with the way we've got money created through debt now, mm-hmm. is that supposedly you're, to get a loan, you're required to put up collateral and, you know.
Well, some people are.
So.
Well, some people aren't.
Don't need to
put up collateral.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, let me ask Stephen. Stephen, the name central bank digital currency to me means that it's on the balance sheet of the central bank, right?
It would be a liability or a credit. It would be a liability given the bank money system, but some people want it to be a social credit on a separate ledger.
And won't they come out essentially on the same basis as Federal Reserve notes?
Yes.
Federal Reserve notes are not liabilities of the Federal Reserve.
I think they are.
No, they're not. I read you the law before. You want me to read it again?
Yes, read it again.
I think they put them on the...
The said notes shall be obligations of the United States and shall be receivable by all national and member banks and Federal Reserve banks and for all taxes, customs, and other public dues. Period.
And that's the section that has to be changed, that Powell said would have to be changed, right?
I don't know what he said.
I thought he said we needed to, this is about a year or two ago, that we'd need to make a change in the law first.
But he didn't say which part of the Federal Reserve.
No, he did not.
Let me respond to Randy, though. Yeah. Randy, when I listened to what you read about the Federal Reserve note, And the suggestion there, to me, actually, I'm not worried if it's about in law or not. The assumption there is that it's a liability of the United States government, and that's the accounting for it runs differently, and it runs through the banking system.
Aren't we talking here about being concerned about debt, money as debt instead of money as not debt?
Right, right. I am very concerned about that.
Then that's what this is talking about. Obligations of the United States.
Okay. No, wait. Read the part about the Federal Reserve note. It is an obligation.
Federal Reserve notes to be issued at the discretion of the Federal Reserve Board for the purpose of making advances to Federal Reserve banks through the Federal Reserve agents as hereinafter set forth and for no other purpose are hereby authorized, the said notes shall be obligations of the United States and shall be receivable by all national and member banks and Federal Reserve banks and for all taxes, customs, and other public dues, period.
Steve, remember Bob Poteet used to say that when he gave his talks. He would say, the Federal Reserve creates Federal Reserve notes, which are debt, and the banks create their bank money, which is debt. So the Federal Reserve is a pyramid of debt.
Correct.
That's what Bob Poteet would say.
Yep. And they have completely swamped the actual honest real money system that was anticipated that this nation would use and did use for quite a while.
But I'm clear with Sue and Randy, I agree with both of you. It's like a Ponzi scheme, and it's just, you know, the whole system is based on debt, builds up, And it's growing, you know. I guess Poteet and others said 7% since the time of the American Revolution. So, it's a disaster.
The federal borrow.
Yeah.
No, there was a point in the 1832, was it, that Jackson actually paid off the national debt?
Yeah, but if you still, if you look at it on a curve over time, and I think.
I know, yeah. But what I'm saying is that the money system was not totally debt-based at that time.
Yeah.
Because we still had money even though the public debt was paid off. We still had money out there circulating around. We don't do any of that anymore.
Right.
Dependent upon the process of someone signing a loan instrument,
right?
Whether it's a corporate bond or a muni bond or whatever.
When I look at the colonial Pennsylvania 100 years earlier, in 1837, at the time of the worst depression in the United States. There was a lack of money, and and so it was a serious situation. You're making a good point. There was money, and but there wasn't enough money for the productivity.
Well,
there wasn't enough medium of exchange.
That depends on the condition of the wealth production. That's what Saadi's trying to get at. He's rate. It's not the amount of wealth that gets produced.
Right.
It's the rate at which it's being produced. How much in a given time?
Yeah, right, but things can get frozen. You know, woolens and metal goods were stuck on the harbor of English metal and goods, and the trees that needed to get to the shipyards weren't getting to the shipyards.
Yeah.
Everything was cataclysmic.
And we had COVID, and all the container vessels out in San Pedro Harbor were backed up and couldn't get unloaded.
Right, right.
Supply chains. That's distribution, not production.
Right. Well, if it doesn't get produced to begin with, then there's a problem.
Money is the distributor.
Yes, that's right. And in the 1830s, there was a great lack of distributors.
Yes. In fact, after the Civil War, that was really the reason why the...
I have a Civil War question related to money and inflation for Saadi's book, but Mary has her hand up. Let's go to Mary.
This might be simple. So when you refer to money that was real money in circulation around 1837 or through the 19th century there, you mean gold coins?
Yeah, mostly. That's what we had, yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
And silver coins,
gold and silver coins,
we're
right.
We're talking coins. Okay, thank you. Because all the paper money, is it true that all the paper money except the greenbacks and except what the scrip before the country reformed, all the rest of the paper money was all bills of credit from banks to somebody, right?
Yeah, generally.
Okay. All right, thank you.
There were some issuances that were state issued. Stevens talked about that in Pennsylvania. And there were some as well
in the colonies.
Yeah.
In the colonies, yeah. But there was, in the early 19th century, there were in the 1830s, there were those shimplaster things, created by banks that circulated as money until the banks went
out. Well, that was a private bank issue, though. That wasn't a
government-issued
token.
True. Okay, yeah.
Sue has her hand up.
Yeah, I just want to say one other thing I learned about the nature of our current money system and the Federal Reserve Law. And I learned it from my research over those many months for my Debt Drives War and War Drives Debt paper. Because, as we all know, the economists don't speak the same language we do. They don't want to. They obfuscate, right?
As much as it can.
I kept trying to figure out the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve when it started, right? And all these terminologies, that these people were using back then, just like today and everything. So what I finally figured out from really trying and trying and finally getting the sources. So when the Federal Reserve started, what Randy read from the law is the power they had to create an elastic currency. Now keep that in your mind. That's their power, to create an elastic currency. We know that today as they create reserves, right? That's their elastic currency. It's digital in the computer today. That's the... Back then, in 1914, they would talk about, the deposits that we have.
Right.
Those reserves they create. That's the elastic currency. And what that is digital. Back then, in 1914, back then they had ledgers, right? So that was like they wrote in their balance sheet. And they said, okay, well, the banks don't really want all of our elastic currency as paper, so we'll just make a deposit for them, and they can use the deposit, right? It's much more convenient, right? So that's the reserves that we see today are really paper dollars that are on deposit at the Fed for these banks. It's all the same. It's all the elastic currency. Some are on deposit, and some are sold at 100% value to the commercial bank, depending on what the bank, what goes on. It's the same.
Base value.
What?
Base value.
Right.
Not the cost of production, but the face value.
But my point is that when they start talking about central bank digital currency, they're talking about these reserves. This is what the central bank has the power to create.
Right. When Randy read the elasticity, and you mentioned the elasticity of money, the central bank digital currency, the central bank digital coins, currency, whatever they come up with, that would be in the same category in my mind. It's elastic, but the difference is it's going to be cash in the sense that it's going to be the real money. It's going to be the real sovereign fiat money that the government's going to declare as being fiat money.
Why is it sovereign, Steve?
If in my mind, if the government says it's the money and the treasury is going to be the first one spending it, yes, then it would be sovereign money.
Who's creating this money?
The Fed. And then the question is, can the Fed give it directly to the federal government then? Or right. Give it in some amounts, and there's been some conversations recently that says, yeah, the government cannot stipulate what it gets. The Fed's got to do it based on its monetary policy.
Yes, but you said
all one-sided. That's all one-sided from recent information or possibilities from, you know, from some of our monetary friends. And then the other one, you know, that Titus is referred to is Carson's, and the biz is also going on the opposite side, said CBDC should be created when banks loan money.
Right, but you just said the Fed creates the CBDC, didn't you?
Say again?
Didn't I hear you just say the Fed creates the CBDC?
Yeah, they would. If the Fed creates it, yes. I'm not sure what we mean by creating it. Yeah, no. If the Fed creates it, in this case, the Fed or Fed would issue it, yes.
And so then, according to the current law, it's a liability. It's not sovereign money. It's a liability of us, the U.S.
Yeah, let's go back to.
It's an obligation.
The balance.
An obligation.
In my mind is when the Federal Reserve takes on assets, and that's, you know, mortgage-backed securities or bonds or other things, and then it puts out dollars. Those dollars are then a liability of the Treasury, and it's if I remember right, it's on the liability side of the Fed's balance sheet.
The reserves that they give to the banks to buy the bank's assets.
Yeah, it's on the Fed's liability side. And the push now is to get it off of that and for CBDCs to be on a ledger. And maybe cash can go on a ledger then too, by the way. There would be no difference between them in my mind.
But it's a sub-ledger of the ledger of the federal bank.
Yes.
So it's still a debt to the government.
You want me to read
to you what they're supposed equity. To be? It's a social equity of the government for the people.
Wait a minute, where did you get that?
Yeah, where did you get that?
That's from Kumhoff and Almarova in a 2020 paper. There were six of them. And they said they want, and just to make sure they're clear about it, they said, we're not going to use CBDC, even though Kumhoff is the one who coined that. He created the acronym CBDC, but he said he's going to use the term CBM for central bank money to be very specific that it's issued by the central bank that earns the seniorage from it.
So it's not sovereign money.
That would be sovereign money if
whoops, did he freeze?
Yeah.
He's Uh-oh. Been sort of on the edge of that for quite some time.
Uh-oh.
None.
Well, just to log back in, we'll probably all know it because we'll all disappear too. It's his Zoom.
Disappeared.
Oh,
so we.
That's right.
We might have to log back in.
It's Steven's Zoom.
So we have the conversation that Sue has been carrying on, and then Joe has got his hand raised. Is he going to be able to come back in?
Don't know.
Recording stopped.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
Sue is the host now.
Sue is the host now.
So you may have to let Steven back in.
We need Steven. Let me call him.
Well, don't be in a rush. Let him. He had to assign the host, so I'm sure he did that before he logged out. So.
How do you know that Sue is the host?
Because I got a notice on my screen.
I didn't
either.
Yes, I'm just lucky.
Maybe you're the host.
Yeah.
A boy named Sue. I think I ought to write a tune about that.
That was a good one. Johnny Cash. I like Johnny Cash.
Yeah, that's right. No, I also have my doubts about whether or not it was actually legal or allowed under law for the Federal Reserve to actually own property. The original Federal Reserve Act simply empowered the Federal Reserve to act in the financial sector.
Yeah. You mean owning the banks, the 12 facilities? Is that what you're referring
to? Yeah, the only physical property they could deal in was the stuff to set up their buildings and offices. They couldn't buy property and sell it. In fact, there was one of the prohibitions in there was making loans, banks within the Federal Reserve districts making loans on agricultural property.
Joe, you want to talk?
They put a specific time limit on that. How many years, you know, you could not lend money for more than 5 years on a piece of ag land if you were a member bank.
I'm going to call Stephen.
I'm calling Steve.
You're calling him?
Yeah.
Okay. Get him in this conversation.
Yes. He's...
Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Well,
Joe's going to come back in?
He has to hear. Right? I would say Stephen needs to hear that. Let me interject while we try to get Stephen back in. I just wanted to add
can you dial in on the phone?
Oh, he can't get in? Uh-oh.
Well, maybe his computer internet connection is down.
Oh, that's why his connection was...
Okay, great.
Hooey.
So Steve's trying something, I don't know the technology, something about hotspots, and if it doesn't work, he said he'd dial in.
Right.
Oh, okay. Well, let's just wait a minute before you hold your thought, Joe, so that Stephen can be part of that, and Susan, Sue also, what you guys were talking about. I just want to add in a piece of fluff from Sadi. Because on page 166, this is a segment he's talking about gold value versus goods value. And in the last paragraph, before you get to how the gold value of money was maintained, that segment, right before that, he's talking about theft. And he says in the last paragraph, if we look ahead, averting our eyes from the haphazard discoveries of gold that can make and unmake fortunes and the irregular growth of knowledge and invention, the purchasing power of money is settled in the long run, neither by science, finance, nor trade, but by the proportion of his earned income, the worker's earned income that the worker permits to be taken from him by the rentier. So, and then he gets into estimating how much theft has been going. Oh, there's Stephen. Okay.
Yay.
We're filling time to continue the discussion. So Joe's next, but Sue wanted to, had something that you were in the middle of?
No, I was just talking with Stephen about how, I can't understand how, Steve, you could say CBDC is sovereign money. This doesn't...
You're muted, Stephen.
You know what, CBDCs are ill-defined. Some people want them to be created in a sovereign way, and other people, the biz, wanted to be created through bank money exclusively, from both extremes, and in lots of ways, in terms of it being digitally controlled by some central authority, that's worrisome. Kumoff had an answer for that, though, and but it's nonetheless a worry in any case. And the other problem is we don't, you know, we're the banks are just going to keep pulling the wool over our eyes to try to make it to their favor, and right now it seems like from Kumoff, and you know, we're going to lose. We lose 66%. And on last week's call, Joe was very adamant that we're not to lose. We have to go forward, and we have to take the high ground, what I would call morally the high ground. And then on that note, I'll let Joe speak. He's got his hand up.
Okay. You know, so there's sort of a question on the table with regard to whether CBDC or CBM or whatever you want to call it, because it seems
CBM is very clearly defined by Kumoff as being government issued and more or less given over to the Treasury, or, you know, it's going to contain the seniorage in that CBM.
So the bank, there's no role in that.
No, not for CBM, yes.
You mentioned earlier that Kumoff claimed some authorship just with regard to the term central bank digital money.
Yeah, he did. A letter.
People that get that license of authorship enter no limits. And to me, changing it to central bank money right in the middle of the screen is proof that it's no more nor no less than controlling the narrative of what it is that we're trying to talk about and what we're trying to understand, because we are the sovereign money people. We're the reformers. We're the sovereign money people. We should know what sovereign money is and whether it has more dimensions than what's apparently on the table, like as if a guy from the Bank of England ought to be trusted was changing the name of the... What is it? What is it that's going on? Nobody really knows, you know? So let's just change the name, and then we'll have a new focus. But I want to say this, okay? The monetary sovereignty is an important political economic reality of everything that we do.
Yep.
Monetary sovereignty does not just mean that there's an imprimatur from the state on the money. Okay, that's not monetary sovereignty. Who created the money and issued it into circulation and gained from that? Who did it? That's what determines whether or not it's monetary sovereignty. And the authors here who were principally involved in the creation of the European Union, the European Monetary Union, we're very clear. Monetary sovereignty must include total freedom of the government to do everything with the money. It's not something that can be channeled. Not something that can be delegated. It's not something that can be put aside. If you don't both issue the money and gain from its issuance, What was my badge? What's my badge word? What is my 130 form? The priority use of the money supply. What did Lincoln say when he issued the greenbacks, when he finally realized? He said, the supreme prerogative of government.
Right.
The supreme prerogative of government. So, you know, Michael Kormoff coming around saying, well, it's going to be central bank money, and we're going to call it sovereign, you know, and we're going to count it as if it was the good of the people.
Yeah.
He's a charlatan. He's a charlatan.
Well, I'm not sure you're getting the clean end of the stick.
That's what he is. Okay, yeah. And he gets together with Omarova, who, you know,
yeah,
let's call it social equity. Hey, how's that? That sounds pretty sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds pretty sovereign.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying it's because we don't start out with an understanding of monetary sovereignty itself at all.
Right.
It's like it's swept under the rug.
Yeah.
And so here we are at this late date, trying to figure out if Omarova and Kormoff have really articulated a gain to the people,
right,
from something that they're ostensibly doing on our behalf. In reality, there's no such thing as central bank money in what they're talking about, nor central bank digital currency. The whole discussion is of a new payment system, is of a new method by which the owners of the data can be able to manipulate the data and take their cut of what it is that they're doing, which would be every transaction going on in the global economy. Okay, that's what they want. The central bankers want that. Why? Because the debt-based money system don't work. That's why they want it. They know it don't work. They know they need to be saying that they're doing something different. And we're going to let them get away with it, apparently, because we don't even get the politics of central banking in Western Europe as well as the authors of the book on monetary sovereignty. And
can you put that book up one more time?
Yeah, who's the author?
Modern Sovereignty.
And who's the author? I can't see the author. Oh,
John Goodman, Professor John Goodman. One of these guys who, I don't think he was a doctor, but maybe he was.
That John Goodman?
Yeah, that John Goodman.
That John Goodman.
But anyway, his he says, sovereignty refers to the legal and political authority that makes the state supreme in its domain.
Right.
Monetary autonomy means that a state is able to set and maintain a monetary policy which is not driven by international markets or exchange rate regimes.
Ouch.
So if you don't have that, and you don't get that with central bank money or central bank digital currency, then you don't have monetary sovereignty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry, let me get my hand.
And that's what's not part of the current conversation about CBDCs.
Right.
Or CBM or whatever else.
Well, right, I agree with both of you. It's missing, yep. You know, and it's a supposition in either direction, and we're, you know, it's like driving a wagon with horses pulling, but they're not connected to the wagon.
Well, yeah, one of them's aimed forward and one of them's aimed back, and they're
basically they're going in different directions.
Yeah. Well, anyway, It's like, you know, the fact is, and I laid the fact out, okay? It's been a long time, and I'm going to say like 10 years more than 10 years, central bankers know that they cannot fix the global economy with a debt-based money system, okay? They know that
that's an important thing, because that's not what I don't hear that in many places. I'll get that book and I'll chuck it into it. I'm not getting that from Carson's and Company.
You don't have to check on the book for what I just said. What you have to do is you have to watch or read, the interview on the Cobden Center. It's the 2015 with Dr. William White, who was then the
I know him. I know who he is.
International Settlements Director of Monetary Policy, Monetary and Economic Policy. He was that. Okay.
Yeah, he was okay. The bearer of that.
And he says right in there, he says, the central bankers are worried. Central bankers are worried, not about what everybody talks about, which is the liquidity issue, but the insolvency issue, the insolvency issue, that you can't keep making more debt. When you make more debt than money, you keep making more debt than money. You keep making more debt. Stephen, you know, this is old as the hills. This is the social credit. The social credit philosophy, the Canadian social credit strategies. But it's also a fact of reality. The person who it was Dr. Michael Kumhoff, in case people don't remember. And he was given one of his talks, and he said, and by the way, I've heard a lot of people here talking about the interest problem. There is no such thing as the interest problem, he says. It's a conspiracy theory. He says, if anybody wants to know about how to prove it, there's been many studies that have been done, and I'd be glad to show them. I raised my hand, And I asked him about it afterwards. I just said, well, what are you going to point us to? Because I've read all the ones that I know about, and none of them really deal with the issue. Where does the money come from to pay the interest? Where does it come from? That's the only question. And they water it down, and they color it, and they make it foggy, and they make it into the fact that somebody can create profits. And if they create the profits, then those profits can become money to be. Where does the money come from to create the profits?
Yeah.
Does it come from debt or not from debt? Because if it comes from debt, you need more debt to have more money. Period. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that now, but is that? And I hope this is recorded and you can give it to Dr. Kumhoff, because I still want to know how he says.
No, the recording stopped. The recording stopped when he walked off.
No. Oh, crap.
I'm recording in progress.
It's being recorded. And oh, gosh. I'll throw a few more notes. I forgot. I got kicked off and I got to start it again.
I have a digital recording of it. I'll send a digital recording.
Good. Oh, good. If you send me, if you put it out, I'll put it in the one mailing, because I'm going to have two Zoom videos with the audio, and then if you give me the supplement, Sue, I'll get that out to everybody too.
Okay, I'll send you the digital voice recording.
By the way, I just want to make this last point. Okay, central bank money is a term that has been widely used in all central banking in all the world. Okay, and it's reserves. That's what central bank money is. And when you read the audits of the central banks themselves, and I'm talking including the Fed. Okay, that's what they call it, central bank money. So to come up with this big new term, central bank money, by coming up, but they don't want to call it currency because he realizes it ain't currency.
Over. Could you repeat the source? It was Michael White or something at a meeting, I think you said in 2015, that was talking about.
I'll post the link to Dr. White's interview, two-part interview on the Cobden Center.
When I looked at interest rates and how it was affecting Colonial Pennsylvania, I wrote a long paper on interest rates back then, and I tend to agree with you, Joe, very much so. Kumhoff, for him to get away with what he's saying, is it requires the banks to be receiving their money, the interest money, and spending it back into circulation right away. And the in like, for example, I think I brought it up here before, in Eric's case in the Philippines, when those people are indebted to their local banks under debt peonage, and then the whole country is indebted to the to the Western banking system, they're in double jeopardy, and they can't get the goods they need. So and in rural areas it's even harder. In Indonesia, and Dejud Mester talks about the need for local currencies, so it's a fairly desperate situation, but it
also debilitates.
It all says that Kumhoff is wrong, and I agree with Joe on what he's saying. And I was there with Kumhoff when he was saying it too. I was wide eyed because I knew I was feeling things differently already then.
What were you going to say, Randy?
When, as Stephen was talking about the Philippine situation with Eric, it replaces the what he's trying to it, by making it harder for him and his associates to make tools and production for the local community. It substitutes the goal of money for the goal of wealth production. It forces you to go seek money first, wealth production later. When what is needed is, you can do it without the money. Make the wealth first, then you can, that's the way up. Screw the money.
But Randy, you're a physiocrat.
Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to allow that because don't look behind the curtain. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Right.
Thank you, Mary, by the way.
Sister.
Yours.
Sue.
I just had the thought, perhaps Kumhoff feels like he can use this terminology in the way he's using it, because in England, the Bank of England is owned by the government at this point, right?
Yeah.
Our Federal Reserve is not owned by our government.
No, in fact, the federal government is prohibited by law from holding stock in the Federal Reserve System.
Right. So maybe that's where he feels like he has the liberty to say that.
Although in Britain, I think it's a toss-up as to which one owns what. Does the government own the bank, or does the bank own the government? Is there a difference?
That's the same here. The legal terms are different. The little structure is different. But it's the same question. Does the bank own the government, or does the government own the bank?
Well, let's hear what Mike has to say.
So, Sue, that was my exact thought about this discussion here is, and let me back up a little bit. First thing is, having discussion with Jeff and Joe and Bill in Canada, understanding how their bank works, and, the differences between how other central banks and the Federal Reserve functions is critical. Because the Bank of Canada does directly finance the government, and they're allowed to by law, whereas the Federal Reserve is not.
Correct.
And so CBDCs or CBM, it could be useful when you have the government owning the central bank. So that's the first question is, does the government have direct control over the central bank? And then I think the more important question is, does a government to administer a properly functioning economy require a central bank? And this was one of the problems with the NEAT Act, and I do think that this is something that needs to be considered, is post-monetary reform, are you going to constitute a central bank? And the NEED Act does not, as far as I understand it. So this, and it was kind of ambiguous on whether or not post-monetary reform would you have a central bank. And I think that's a meaningful question. Do you need a central bank? Now, companies don't have to have a bank per se. They have a treasury. The most companies have what's referred to as a treasury, where they manage their money, and then they have a private bank administer all the other banking functions they might require. So I think that we need to understand, in terms of the structure of the government, do we really require having a central bank? And I would argue that we don't. We do not require a central bank per se, because a treasury can function in the same ways that a central bank would. But all of the functions of the bank, meaning, you know, making the payments, facilitating the payments, the payment system, that can be in the private domain, as long as the government is in full control of the money. And I, to me, I think that's the most effective way of structuring it. Make the payment systems all private. Make the bankers, you know, compete over the most efficient way to transmit money, but have the money be solely owned by the government, and created and first use goes to the government or we the people. That's
well,
my thought.
Created and it goes, it's distributed via the provisions in the NEED Act, adding in a parity provision.
Joe, I think may want to respond too.
Yeah,
well,
to Mike.
Well, it's just that I think what Mike said is right. That is to say that there is no need to have a central bank. What would it do? But I do think that the NEED Act, you know, I mean, it takes the Federal Reserve Act and amends it in many, many ways, and in doing so, it takes all the powers that the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve have had, and institutes them underneath the monetary authority. But the thing is that one of those powers is to be the central bank. Okay? Now, it doesn't make the monetary authority the central bank, but it stops the Fed from being the central bank, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
Well, we have to understand what is a bank. What is a bank doing, right? So is the bank the payment system, or is the bank the originator of the money? And this is where we get confused, because modern banking is money creation via lending. And it, in my opinion, banking should be the maintenance of clients' money. Now, current banking does that too. But again, you know, the treasury, the function of the treasury, which the monetary authority is in the treasury, could hire, contract a private banking institution to administer, or just have the private banks generally administer money in a certain way. There could be laws set up where if you're a bank, then this is how you deal with government and government payments. So, again, I think that monetary reform is, we need to understand the structure of how the monetary system is going to work, and present that as a cohesive argument as to why we want to have, are we going to have a central bank or not as part of the government, and how is it going to function? That's the, how is it going to interact with the banks? And, of course, banking stability of the monetary system, which would, by its very nature, be drastically improved under monetary reform. You know, it almost solves itself in a way. Is that, you know, the problem with having to manage bank solvency and liquidity, it evaporates immediately. Joe's got his hand up.
You know, I've heard it said. I've heard it said that the thing that might make central bank digital currency, or whatever, you know, whatever you want to call that, work is only if the government has, only if we have a public central bank. I'm sorry. Yeah, publicly owned central bank. That was one part of it. That the government was in complete control of the central bank. Now, if you know anything about central banking, and if you know that the Bank for International Settlements does not let anybody in the government be on their board, okay, then at least you're starting to grasp what the thing called central bank or bank independence, okay? Because that's the that's the final thing about monetary sovereignty. Is to understand what the independence is all about. So the idea that there can be this kind of new construct where we're going to have a central bank but we're going to have a central bank issue the currency, central bank money, and yet it's going to be sovereign, is like a smorgasbord, a meal here. And my dad always said, don't be afraid to just make it up as you go along, because that's what they do.
Yeah.
That's what they do, So this is like the perfect example of what my dad was saying right there, It's like central bank independence. They don't talk about anything more than they talk about central bank independence. It has to be independent from the government.
What Zerlinga was pushing for, and I've got to look at the NEED Act for two things, because I haven't looked at it recently, but what he was really hoping for was that the monetary authority, the people who served on that, were paid about roughly the equivalent of Supreme Court justices, and that it would be considered something like the fourth branch of government, the monetary authority. And also, too, I think there were some provisions. While the Fed is hollowed out, I'm not sure if it was totally goes away. So I need to check on both those things. Randy Cook has his hand up.
I think part of the question we struggled to deal with here and are not saying is that as our central bank, the Federal Reserve runs a giant portion of the world.
Yes.
That's just fact. And by changing the basis on which they do business, by changing our money system into a sovereign money system, a sound money system, whatever we want to call it, however it gets done, affects their ability to run what they're running around the world in a big way.
Yeah.
And that is a big tree to drop. Not that it's hard to do, but that the consequences of it are incalculable.
Yeah, right.
We're going to have to figure out something else besides sanctions to get
exactly. In lots of different areas. I mean, yeah.
Something besides what?
Sanctions.
Oh.
How about a parity tariff?
Well, right. International trade. All of those things are connected in it. Go ahead, Mike.
I totally agree. This is a substantial challenge. It's part of the reason why we have to think about the bond market, because what you're talking about is how the bond market functions, because it is considered that Treasury securities are the most stable, secure asset to purchase with the best return.
Right.
At the moment. Well, not anymore when they did what they did to Russia, and then they
exactly
activity as well. That it's not a functioning monetary system. So first thing is the global community is recognizing that the dollar is no longer a secured currency that can be used regardless of circumstances. That's what a monetary system is. Otherwise, it's a tool of political control by a certain group of people.
Yep.
And So that's the first issue that we're dealing with. The second issue, of course, is the effects that monetary reform would have if we're positing eliminating securities in the bond market.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That is what the NEED Act does, is it eliminates that entirely. And so that tool of imperial domination, where we finance our empire with securities, no longer exists.
We can't debt finance
spending to military industrial complex contractors any further with Treasury securities. So I think that is a substantial benefit of what we achieve in terms of, I mean, that's good for the global community. The global community should think of that as being a net positive, you know, and if we combine monetary reform with a peace dividend where we demilitarize, we get rid of these 800, 900 military bases around the world, stop doing this crazy kind of control thing that we're doing.
We ain't the only ones doing it.
That's true.
Who else? Who, the West that we control?
BRICS.
What are they trying to control, though? I mean, they're trying to achieve, have a positive trade organization.
No.
Do their things.
They're trying to make sure we don't take over control of the world by trying to take over what they can take control of.
Does BRICS have a navy or an army, or are they bombing?
Yes, they do. It's at work now, honing its tools in Ukraine.
Well, we're getting off subject here.
I'm just saying that we are not a monolithic force in the world.
But we
have our opposition.
I think we're a major one, and with monetary reform, it's going to be a lot more difficult. I think impossible to create the base or support the bases with the monetary reform.
Absolutely.
The military. Anyway, Mary's had her hand raised, and then I think Stephen is.
Right. Mary.
Well, I really appreciate what Mike brought up. And from my point of view, sidebar here, I think of BRICS as a self-defense outfit. Okay, I'll let that go, though, because what I have been thinking about lately is how our proposal does eliminate something so powerful and so we don't even talk about it. And who understands the bond market? I think we really have to talk about that because people are not going to go for the NEED Act until they understand, feel like they have some sense of, well, what's going to happen to everything we know? The bond market is like everything we know.
Right.
The bond market controls everything, and nobody quite understands how. Man. But I really, really appreciate having that brought up, and that would be very cool if there's somebody, like for the AMI conferences, who can talk about the bond market, how it works, how it has all that power, and I read like the book called The Bond King, and then also in the book about the people the people who got ahead of the 2008 thing and made a lot of money on it, the Big Short people.
Right.
And the bond market is in the background of all that.
Sure.
Who can manage to control that bond market? And then recently there was some famous guy I talked to in an interview on the Sheer Post. I can't think of what his name was. He said, I used to think I wanted to come back as a king or something like that. He said, I got it figured out now. I want to come back as the bond market, some power hungry person. So I think it's really an important topic that I want us to begin to talk about. Sorry for being so long to get there.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Randy Cook can help, and probably Mike too. Go ahead, Stephen. Sorry.
No, just now I'm jumping ahead. I notice it's 9:15 and I have about 5 minutes left. Mike has his hand up.
I didn't take my hand down, but I can say, a few things here about the bond market. You know, this is part of the reason why the RPC had been issuing the position paper on what we're doing with the bond market, meaning getting rid of it. And we used, of course, Joe's dad's statement that investor preference should have no influence over monetary operations, basically is what we said. And that's from Joe's dad. You know, and I believe that's accurate. That is the correct thing, is that we should not be having monetary policy that's based on investor preference. That's silly. So I'll turn it over to Joe.
Yeah, well, Sue's ready to come on. And what I just wanted to mention real quick, I was going to mention, I have a whole take on BRICS. And I can share that some other time, too. But anyhow, Sue, go ahead.
I want to ask this question that no one's been able to give me an answer to. Why?
You couldn't wait any longer to give it to us?
I don't have the answer. I'll just say the question. You go to the official website of the BIS, and they have a list of central banks that are members. Mm-hmm. And there is the Russian Central Bank and the Chinese Central Bank are members of the BIS.
Sure.
And what's your question then, Sue?
Why? Why are they still members?
Because they can get blackballed well enough. And it's convenient. China owns a ton of U.S. securities, and the trade with China is still tremendous. So it's hard to get rid of that, and I think they've blackballed, you know, Russia from the SWIFT payment system, and other similar measures.
Yes, but Stephen, the powers that be are always doing things that on the media sound like, oh, yes, they're against us, they're for us, they're against us. It's part of the how the media is used to keep the truth away. The BIS, the BIS, what's the author, Hope and Tragedy? Tragedy and Hope?
Carol Quigley.
Quickly, that was the famous paragraph in his Tragedy and Hope book. That was
page 64.
That was taken out of the later editions, pointing especially to the control of the world by the central bankers. And the central bankers meet every month. They meet in Basel at the Bank for International Settlements, and they go into this room. There's nobody taking notes, there's no recording or anything, and they make decisions. And then they all go fly back to their countries, to their central banks. They do it once a month.
They don't send you a notice.
No, how about that?
Nope.
Stephen's got the paragraph.
Well, I'm checking it out.
Well, you got the 66 version of Quigley's book?
I think so. This is an early version. I don't know if it's...
They like the appearance of legality, for one. They don't necessarily be legal, but they like the appearance of legality.
Right.
And the investments that are held in the hands of the Chinese and the Russians and the Indians and Brazilians and South Africans still have value in terms of the central bank of the United States of America, and they're unwilling to part with that. So they will still continue to be members of the BIS.
Yeah, it's just not in their interest. It's just not in their interest to not be part of it.
Correct.
Because you know, the BRICS are not opposed to central banking.
True.
I mean, I've never heard that they were. So, but what they're trying to do is just to free themselves from the petrodollar primarily.
Right.
And with that, advance their own standard of living instead of the standard of living of the people that are controlling the money.
The money hoards. Yeah.
Over.
Well, it's getting, it's 9:20. Did you have something you wanted to say, Stephen, about BRICS before we...
No, it's too long. I'll say it. The next Chinese time? Banking system and the rest of BRICS, I identify with those smaller countries and what's going on in BRICS, and I see us as the little people that have to work with China and the Federal Reserve System or the ECB to make the world better. So we've got a big task in front of us.
I think the first thing in making the world better is to make sure that our monetary systems, such as they are, as opposed to what we need them to be, we need them to serve the interests of the people.
Yes.
Not the interests of the money loaners, the money lenders, the interest setters, the bank supervisors, the payment system administrators.
The rentiers.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Very much.
People who rent us their private money in lieu of not having a public money system.
We didn't get too far into Chapter 8. Does that mean I should come back next week for the next session?
Right. Yeah.
Maybe we'll start reading at the beginning, or do we have homework?
We were supposed to read Chapter 8.
Yeah.
So, and then,
well,
then...
Yeah, we should read the first 5 pages then on our own to where... the section that Randy brought up earlier.
No, you should read the part about the evils of a variable standard.
That seems like
a free market system for the middleman to get in there.
And Jerry wants us to read about maintenance of the gold something.
Well, the first paragraph in his chapter, and then get into the evils of, that would be on page 172.
I can't tell you the page number.
That's what I've got. The evils of a variable standard is okay. What you said.
Yep, right? That's right. Yep.
What does Joe want to say?
Nothing. Nothing.
Followed by the evils of a shortage of currency.
Yep. Oh. Shortage of currency, yep. Oh, yeah, that's another thing, huh?
Yeah.
You know what? People aren't using money as much. And by the way, it has nothing to do with the pandemic and the lockdowns and the fact that, you know, you can't go out and spend it anywhere. No, it has nothing to do with that. This has to do with consumer preferences that we're trying to beat.
Right. Yes.
So next week is going to be Chapter 8, first paragraph, and then we jump ahead.
Thank you all very much for being here.
Thanks, everybody. It's great.
I agree.
Thank you so much. Notes on our meeting.
Thank you.
Great.
Very glad to have come back.
Yay, Mary.
Yeah.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, all.
Bye.